Okay, we begin here on the top of Ayin Aleph Amud Aleph, 4 lines down. The Gemara left off yesterday with the statement of Rav Huna that Rav Nachman had quoted with regards to the pasuk Marveh Hono B'Neshech V'Tarbit Luchanein Dalim Yikpitzenu. And Rav Huna seemed to indicate that that was a reference to collecting interest from non-Jews. So even though the Torah seemingly explicitly permits such an activity, nevertheless, Midrabanan, they said that it was asur. The reason it was asur is shelo yilmod mimasav, so he shouldn't learn from the ways of the non-Jew. That could be interpreted of one of two ways. Is either that it will engender a certain amount of closeness or friendship because you're dealing with him actively on a regular basis, or it could be that if you lend to him with interest, that will be margil, that will make it for you commonplace that you're charging interest, and then you may go ahead and charge interest to the Jew. So then we permitted it, b'kadei chayav, when it was absolutely necessary, or the ability to procure oneself a livelihood. In that case, we allowed it. And the possibility is because the explanation of the pasuk is marbe hono b'neshech v'tarbit. The restriction is against accumulating wealth through the charging of interest, but not for creating parnosa or getting parnosa through the charging of interest. So that's how we left off yesterday. The Rabbeinu Tam discussed the problem they faced in Europe and said that they did lend with interest, and the permissibility of it has to do with the next part of the Gemara, which is because some people have that statement of Rav Huna qualifying the following and not the pasuk that we brought from Mishlei. The Tani Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef had a braita. Im kesef talve tami ete ani imach. This is the pasuk from Mishpatim that tells us that if you're going to lend money to the poor, you should take care of ani imach, the poor person who is with you. So then the Gemara says, Ami v'nachri, it's a choice between a Jew and a non-Jew. Ami kodem, you pick a Jew. What's interesting about this is the fact that the Gemara here entertains the possibility of giving to the Nachri. In other places, in the Gemara Gittin, it speaks about the fact that you give staka to Eniye Nachrim because of Bnei Shalom, but it doesn't speak about a specific mitzvah. But over here, it seems that the Gemara views this as a masetov, or something that is considered in the realm of possibility that giving to the Nachri is a good deed. But you have a choice between Ami and Nachri, then you would pick Ami. Ani v'ashir, if you have a choice between giving to a poor person or someone who is wealthy, ani kodem, then the poor person goes first. And again, here you have an indication that sometimes giving money to the ashir is also deemed to be tzedakah in cases where his liquidity is difficult and you're facilitating his ability to have liquidity, or in a case where he's fallen on hard times and you're trying to restore his kavod, restore him to his former self. So there is also a mitzvah of tzedakah to the ashir. Aniecha v'aniye irecha. So if it is your aniyim or the aniyim of your city, aniecha kodmim, then your aniyim are kodem. Your aniyim refer to aniyim that are krovei mishpacha, family. Some people who are close to you, not just because of their location, but because of their familial ties. Aniye irecha v'aniye iracheret. If it's the poor people of your city versus the poor people of another city, aniyei erecha kodmim, then the aniyim of your city come first. And that's because the pasuk says, etehe ani imach. The ani that is with you is the one that you're obligated to take care of. And so therefore you would focus on the ani that is the closest to you. So the closest would obviously be family. There might be an additional requirement to mibisarcha lo titaleim, that you should not look askance when your own flesh, meaning some filial tie, that makes an additional demand on you to provide and to take care of them. Sometimes that's the hardest to have to deal with. But then after that, you have to deal with those that are proximate to you, meaning in your location. And then beyond your location, then obviously it's Jews that take precedence over non-Jews. Amar, amar, ami v'nachri, ami kodem. When it comes to Jews and non-Jews, Jews go first. Pshita, that's a given. I don't even need a pasuk to tell me that. That seems obvious that you would always make that choice. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Li Huna. So here is the statement of Rav Huna now. Lo nitzrucha tafilu l'nachri biribit u'l Yisrael b'chinam. You have a choice between lending to the non-Jew with interest or to the Jew interest-free. You should lend to the Jew interest-free. So even though you're giving up the opportunity for profit, nevertheless, there is a priority given to the tzedakah, given to the Jew, lending him without interest versus lending to the goy with interest. And based on this, the Rabbeinu Tam suggested, since this is an alternative way to read Rav Huna, you have two possibilities as to which is the qualification upon which Rav Huna's statement was said. And since it's a din d'rabbanan, we'll go to the hakel. And therefore, the issur d'rabbanan that we read about in the previous version of Rav Huna's statement is not normative because of the fact that we have an alternative way to read it, which is the kula. And that's how the Rabbeinu Tam justified possibly charging interest to non-Jews, even though there was such a restriction in the Rabbanan. What's interesting is that the Rabbeinu Hai Gon says over here that in places or locations where the non-Jews don't charge interest, which in Christian Europe was a problem because of the usury laws, he says that the Jews shouldn't do it either because it is a Chilul Hashem. The fact that they are charging interest and that the Christians were unwilling to charge interest. So it's interesting perspective because you have the Rav Haigon, who's obviously a step away from what's going on in Europe. It was true in Muslim countries as well in terms of charging of interest, but there they also, I think, had something akin to a heter iska, which that they did utilize, but they also had the ability to charge the Jews the interest, whereas in the Christian countries, you weren't allowed to charge interest to anybody. It didn't matter whether it was believer or non-believer, you weren't allowed to charge interest. So then the Rav Haigon, writing from the outside, says, then the Jews also shouldn't charge interest. The Rabbeinu Tam, who lives there, and says this is our only means of livelihood, he's saying that we need to do this, otherwise we're not going to survive. We're not allowed in any professions. We're precluded from most professions. The only profession we're allowed to enter into was money lending. And so therefore the Rabbeinu Tam seeks to justify the practice and figure out how it's possible you can do this. Whereas Rav Haigon has indicated that maybe you shouldn't be involved in these types of practices. Tanya, Amar Rav Yossi, Bore Samyot Enehem Shel Malvei Biribit. Come and see how the eyes of those that lend with ribit are blinded. Adam Kore L'Chavero Rasha. If a person calls his friend a Rasha, Yorei Dimo L'Chayav. He can go down to his livelihood. If you look in Rashi, in the Gemara in Kiddushin, on Daf Chav Ched Amar Aleph, Rashi over there describes what it means, Yorei Dimo L'Chayav. Rashi over here says, I can't believe anybody would say that. And he rejects what he gives as the interpretation of this in the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin over there is speaking about people who call someone else names or somehow impede their ability to function in society or their reputation that they are ruining. And what is the retribution that is appropriate? So over there, the Gemara says, if someone calls an individual a Rasha, the proper response is Yorei Dimo L'Chayav. So Rashi over here says, Ragil lehit kotei dimo, kiilu hiko. You should be quarrelsome with him, as if he hit you. Ukiilu balahor go, or as if he came to kill you. Vanisha mati, Rashai lerei letoch umanut shel chavero. You're allowed to go down to his parnosa. Ulema'et mizonotav shel chavero. And then to cause him financial losses or ruin his ability to garner parnasa. V'kasha be'enai says it's very difficult for me to accept this. Shatiru chachamim l'Israel inakeim v'ligmo ra'a, that for a person to take revenge and to pay back bad. Ve'od aminan v'ktubot ad 12 shana mitgagdel adam im bino, that a person should work with his son for 12 months. Become elech yoredi molechayav. And after that, he goes down to his livelihood. Over there, it's not talking about his son's profession. There is no profession over there. There is no parnasa that we're speaking about over there. That's teaching you that you go after him to force him to comply with the Torah's laws. And that you work with him trying to convince him or with a light-handed manner, get him ala derech haTorah. If after 12 months you're unsuccessful, then you take a much harder line approach to get him back on the track of Torah and the Derech HaTorah. But you see, Rashi says that the same expression that's used over there does not reference to going after his parnasa or ruining his business. That's not the definition of it, because over there, by your child, that's definitely not what the explanation of the expression would be. The explanation is that you take a much harder line or serious approach to it. And that's what Rashi says in the beginning, that you put a distance between you. You put some sort of, there's a wedge now, because as if he hit you or as if he came to kill you. And you take seriously the fact that he called you a Rasha. The Bali Tosafot over here bring Katu b'tshuvat ha-gonim b'shein Rav Tzadok Gaon. Yoredim al chayav rashay lisrof shlish tvuato v'teima gadol minayin lozeh. Says that you're allowed to burn down one third of his fields. So again, here, going after his parnasa, and you can burn one third of his possessions because he called you a Rasha. And Tosafot says, teima gadol. Where did he ever get such a thing? So there are those that indicate it comes from the story of Tanur Shel Achnai with Rabbi Eliezer. If you remember there, that was Onat Devarim. And the offense that Rabbi Eliezer took to the Nidui that he was put in, the Gemara there says that because of the Onat Devarim that happened to Rabbi Eliezer, that one third of the olives and one third of the chita were lost in that year because of Rabbi Eliezer's pain. So there you see this idea of Onat Devarim, when someone offends another person with the way that they speak, that that is the result of the Onat Devarim. So that might be the source for this idea of burning one third. You can see the discomfort that Rashi and the Bali HaTosafot have with taking revenge and actively ruining someone else's parnasa. Rashi in Kiddushin states it without any of this qualification. He brings exactly this, that Yoreh L'toch Chayav is literally that you can go after his parnasa. And those that believe that that is the case say that it's a midah keneged midah. When someone calls another party a rasha, that is something that affects their reputation and their nemanut, their believability and their trustworthiness in terms of business transactions, and you are actually ruining their parnasa. And so the retribution is that you can ruin their parnasa. But again, Rashi's question of why would we permit revenge in these cases, that's not the Torah's way in general. We let Hashem take care of these things, but we can see the seriousness, at least, of the issue. So nevertheless, the point of the Gemara here is that when it comes to this type of situation where a person is offended by what the other person is saying about them, term Rasha is a serious term to place on someone else, and therefore you have rights to be upset and angry about such a thing. Over here, with regards to taking of interest, v'heim, mevim edim, over here with the charging of interest, they bring witnesses, v'lavlar, and a sofer, v'kumus, and a stylus or a quill, v'dyo, and ink, v'kotvin, they write, v'chotmim, and they sign, ploni ze kafar belukei Yisrael. So-and-so denied that there's a God in Israel. His point is that when someone calls another person a Rasha, you open up Pandora's box about what he's allowed to do to this other person because of the effect. He meanwhile time, these individuals who are lending with rebate are willing to document, sign, and stamp the fact that they are denying God. God said don't lend with interest, and they go ahead and lend with interest. So his point is, you see how blind they are to the Avera that they're engaging in, to the affront that is to God, that they are willing to document and show that they don't care that which God said. Achad v'kama v'kama, that Hashem is going to be yored l'chayav, that Hashem is going to go after his parnasa. And we're going to see that. Gemara believes that when it comes to malvei b'ribit, when you lend with interest, eventually all your assets dry up. Tanya Rabbi Shimon Elazar Omer, kol mi sheyesh lo ma'ot, o malvei otam shelo b'ribit, anybody who has assets and lends them out without interest, alava katuv omer, about him the pasuk says in Tehillim, kaspo lo natan b'neshech, he did not give his money, did not lend out his money with interest, v'shochad al naki lo lakach, he did not accept any bribery or chanifa, oseele lo yimot leolam, those that do this, mean act appropriately and don't accept interest and don't accept this bribery or flattery, lo yimot leolam, they will not falter forever. That is a stick in the ground, that their money will be preserved. Halamato, from this you learn, shkola malve biribit nechasav mitmotetim, that anybody who lends with interest, all of his possessions will falter. So this is what we mentioned before, that lending with interest, the outcome or the midah keneged midah is you were greedy, you were taking from other people, in most cases did not have the ability to pay for it. And the fact now that you are enriching yourself at the expense of others, the midah keneged midah is that Hashem will cause your money to disappear or falter in this case. Now, the problem is that that is the Pashtuta Pasuk. The Pashtuta Pasuk is exactly the way that Rabbi Shimon Elazar says. You don't need Rabbi Shimon Elazar to tell you that if that's the way to preserve your money, that if you do the other way around, then your money will be lost. What likely Rabbi Shimon Elazar is being mechadesh over here is the fact that you don't need to accomplish all of the things that I mentioned in that Perek Tehillim. Five Pesukim, that Perek. But there it describes what an upstanding individual looks like. In the Pasuk that we quoted, it talks about Shochara Nekilo Glakach. So there are other items that are mentioned there. And the Chiddush of Shimon Lazar is if you just simply don't charge interest, that's enough to garner you the reward that your monies will be preserved. It says, V'aka chazinan, delo mosve beribit, v'aka mitmotetim. Don't we see that basically tzadik v'ralo? There are individuals who do not charge interest, and yet their possessions or their assets still disappear. So Amar Rabbi Lazar, halalo mitmotetim v'olim, v'halalo mitmotetim v'einon olim. Difference is, when their assets falter, is there any recovery from that? Those that falter do have a chance of recovery, have an ability to re-earn those assets. Those that are charging interest, the assets will disappear and they will not come back. Meaning that will be the permanent state of the individual. The Tosfot says, what's the question of the Gemara? Who says that the person's assets didn't disappear from some other aveira that they did? How do you know why the assets were lost? It's one thing if they lent with interest, okay, we understand that their assets are lost. But why is it that there's not other aveirot? And what type of question is that? So he says, Eish lamar de parich de chazinan tzadikim gimurim. We see full-fledged, complete tzadikim, nami mitmotetim, and we see them falter, we see them having trouble with their parnosa. Inami, the question is, according to Rabbi Akiva, that is doresh at the end of Makot, osa eleh, that anybody who does any one of these items will be safe. And again, that's the chiddush of Rabbi Shimon Elazar over here. That if you do any one of these items, that's enough to guarantee you that your money should be preserved. So here these individuals are keeping that mitzvah. They're keeping that mitzvah. Their assets should be preserved. They're protected. So why are they losing their assets? The answer is it's a type of losing of assets. Some people will lose their assets and that will be a permanent state. Other people will lose their assets, but they will be able to recover from that. They will rebound from the difficulties. Lama tabit bugdim tacharish bivala rashat sadik mimenu. We have it here with a kaf, but in the pasuk it's actually with a bet. Lama tabit bugdim. Why will those that rebel look on tacharish and be silent bivala rashat sadik mimenu? When the rasha swallows up the one who is more righteous than he. Amar Avuna. Tzadik mimenu boleya. Someone who's more righteous than he can swallow up. Tzadik gamur eno boleya. But he's a full-fledged tzadik, then he can't swallow him up. This is, I think, another attempt to answer the question, which is the difference between a tzadik gamur and a tzadik mimenu. So the rasha will have the ability to come after the assets or swallow the tzadik, but that's only when he's tzadik mimenu, when he's more righteous than the rasha. But if he's a tzaddik gamur, his assets are protected. Now Rashi qualifies that and says, even the tzaddik gamur will lose his assets, but they will come back. Or the rasha will swallow him up, but he'll get back, or he'll have a rebound. On the other hand, the tzaddik mimenu will be swallowed and not return. So that's one way to interpret it, the way Rashi is saying it. I think you could have read it as an independent answer, which is that when we see people losing their assets, yeah, because they're tzaddikim, but they're not tzaddikim b'emurim. If they were tzaddikim b'emurim, then they wouldn't lose their assets. But again, maybe not an easy statement to make, because we even see very righteous people who lose their assets. Tanya, Rabbi Omer, Ger Tzedek Amur L'Inyan Mechira, the Ger Tzedek that's mentioned in the Parshia with regards to the selling of an Eved Ivri, V'Ger Toshav Amur L'Inyan Ribit, and Ger Toshav was mentioned in the Psukim by Ribit, the charging of interest, Any of that mahu. I don't understand the necessity for them in the psukim. I don't understand how to explain them. Ger tzedek amor liyan mechira. A ger tzedek that's mentioned by the sale of an eved ivri, dichtiv. It says, v'chi amuch achicha imach. When your brother falls on hard times and is impoverished, v'nim karlach. And then he's sold to you. V'lo lach el eleger. But not only is he sold to you, but there's a possibility that he be sold to the ger. Shenemar lager. That he sold to the ger. V'lo lager tzedek, ela lager toshav. Not only to a convert, but even to a ger toshav, definition of which is somewhat ambiguous. Rashi over here, it says someone who's mikabal al atzmo, shelo lavod avodah zarah, someone who accepts not to worship avodah zarah, but he's ochel nevelot. He's not a Jew, he's not accepting of the mitzvot, but he keeps the mitzvah of not worshiping avodah zarah. Many Rishonim believe that it is the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach. Rashi, throughout Shas, when it mentions Ger Toshav, mentions not worshipping Avodah Zarah. So for him, it might be sufficient to be classified as a Ger Toshav in that manner, but he will be sold not to a righteous convert, but to a Ger Toshav. Shneamar, the Ger Toshav. Mishpacha Ger. The pasuk continues and says to the family of the Ger, Ze'anochri, that is the non-Jew. Keshu Omer Ola Eker. When it says afterwards, then, owed to the Eker, Zenim Kalu Vodat Kochamim Atzma. That's one who sold to Avodah Zarah itself. Over there, the Rishonim argue on the Pasuk as to what that means. Does that mean literally you're sold to the Avodah Zarah, and you have to work in the Makom Avodah Zarah, and you're cleaning up the Avodah Zarah, doing the work for the Avodah Zarah? Do we take that very literally? Or, the Vodat Kochamim Atzma means that you have to deal with the people when you're sold to the Oved Kochavim, that you're not only sold to him, but you're subject to his beliefs and his practices because of the fact that you're a slave to him, you're an Eved Ivri to him. So now the question that arises from this is, what does the Ger Tzedek have to do with? In each of these cases, there is a decline in the person's standing. They are sold as a slave, but each time they're sold to someone, which makes it even more of a problem or of a difficult situation. A denigration or difficult situation. At first he's sold to another Jew, but then he's sold to a convert. Then he's sold to a Ger Toshav. Then he's sold to a Nachri. Then he's sold to a Avodat Kochavim. The question is, what's the difference being sold to a Jew versus being sold to a Ger Tzedek? A Ger Tzedek is a Jew. So then what is the step down between a Jew, a full-fledged Israel, and a Ger Tzedek? And that's what Rabbi says. I don't understand what the Ger Tzedek is doing in the Pasuk. So Amar, Lo Lecha, Ela the Ger. Shenemar the Ger. The Memra, the Ger, Kani Eved Ivri. That seems to indicate that a Ger can acquire an Eved Ivri. Piriminu, Ein a Ger Nikne Be Eved Ivri. A Ger cannot be acquired as an Eved Ivri. Ve'ni Shav a Ger Konim Eved Ivri. And a woman and a Ger Tzedek cannot acquire an Eved Ivri. Ger lo nikne be'Eved Ivri. A Ger is not acquired as an Eved Ivri, because the Pasuk says, v'shav el mishpachto be'inan. You have to return to his family, v'haleka, and he doesn't have family. One of the requirements of the Eved Ivri is, whether it's the expiration of the 7 years that he has to work for the owner, or the Yovel, it says, v'shav el mishpachto, he goes back to his family. That assumes that he has family. A Ger Tzedek doesn't have family because it's katan, shenola dummy. If that's the case, then he can't fulfill the v'shava mishpachto, so you can't sell him in as an Eved Ivri. Ve'ini shav a ger konim Eved Ivri. A woman and a ger cannot acquire an Eved Ivri. Isha, simply lavor achara. It's not proper etiquette for a woman to own an Eved Ivri. Most of the problem is the fact that she is purchasing a man to work for her, which are problems of yichud and all sorts of other issues that come up, and therefore it's just inappropriate and understandable why you wouldn't want that. A ger nami gmire de mikne kani, de lo mikne lo kani. By a ger tzedek, the one who de mikne, that can be acquired, kani, he can acquire. De lo mikne, the one who cannot be acquired, lo kani, he himself cannot acquire. So since the ger tzedek can't be sold as an Eved Ivri, he doesn't have the possibility of acquiring an Eved Ivri, because you need to be on both sides of the parsha. So now, how do we have a situation in which the Ger Tzedek is buying the Eved Ivri? So now I understand why it's a step down, because the Geret Tzedek is not subject to the Dinim of Eved Ivri. But now I don't understand, which is, how is he even purchasing the Eved Ivri to be a step down? So Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak enu koneh v'dino k'Yisrael, aval koneh v'dino k'nechri. That you're not allowed to buy an Eved Ivri and have the Eved Ivri be dino k'Yisrael, like the way that Yisrael has a din, aval koneh v'dino k'nechri. But he can acquire him, and his status will be that of a non-Jew. Titanya, Eva Breita. Harnirza vavnimkar l'nechri enu oved lo et ben v'lo et bat. A person who stays on even as an Eved Ivri after his requisite 6 years of work, he wants to stay on. He gets a nirza, he gets his ear pierced, and he remains until the yovel. Hanim karla nachri, someone is sold to a non-Jew. Eno aved lo et ben velo et bat. There's no obligation for that Eved to serve the son or the daughter. Now, in terms of the daughter, that's even if they were an Eved Ivri. A regular Eved Ivri has no requirement to stay on with the daughter. But to be Oved et ben, to work for the child, that indicates that the person is a Yerusha, becomes a possession of the estate, it becomes like Karka, that's why we describe an Eved Kenani. So over here, an Eved Ivri does not have that status. And so therefore, an Eved Ivri is not treated like property, and therefore the daughter has no rights to the Eved Ivri, but the son does step into his father's shoes. Therefore, an Eved Ivri would continue to work for the son, but once he is in Nirtza, once he has his ear piercing, stays until the Yovel, there it says in the Pasuk, V'abadol de'olam, you will work for him forever, forever being to the Yovel, V'lo ben, and not to the son. And in Nimkar, the Nachri, it says, V'chishavim koneu, that when you buy him out, you do a calculation with the one who purchased him. The one who purchased him has rights in him, but not beyond that. So the child of the Nachri does not have a right to that Eved Ivri, and therefore he would go free at the death of the individual who purchased him. So now, that's what it means over here, that he does not acquire an Eved Ivri that has a din like Yisrael, but rather koneh v'dino k'nachri. He acquires him and he has a din like a Nachri, which means that the Eved Ivri will not be passed down to his child. The Eved Ivri will be freed as soon as the ger passes away. That's not only when he's a nirtza, but even if he was just a regular Eved Ivri. If he was sold to a Jew, the son would step into the shoes of his father. Here, since he was sold to a Geret Tzedek, the Geret Tzedek can only buy the Eved Ivri like a Nachri. Therefore, if he passes away, his child would not step into his shoes to keep the Eved Ivri. So that's how we solve the problem. That's how you can have a Geret Tzedek acquire an Eved Ivri. But he acquires an Eved Ivri like a Nachri. And that's why it's a step down. A Jew acquires him like an Eved Ivri, and then the Geret Tzedek acquires him like a Nachri. Happens to be that it gives him more rights in this case, because then he will not be passed down to the son of the Geret Tzedek. But that is the step down, and the ability for the Geret Tzedek to acquire an Eved Ivri, even though we just saw before that a Ger cannot acquire an Eved Ivri. That is that he can't acquire him as a Jew with Dinei Yisrael. What he can do is acquire him with the Dinim of a Nachri that acquires a Jew. Amamar. Venisha veger konim Eved Ivri. A woman and a ger cannot acquire an Eved Ivri. Neima deloki Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Let us suggest that that statement in the Braita is against the position of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. D'tanya, isha kona et hashvachot. A woman is allowed to buy an ama ivriya. Veino kona et avadim. But she's not allowed to acquire slaves. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel omer, Af koneh et avadim. She is even entitled to buy the slaves in Eved Ivri. So afilu teimer Rabbi Shimon Gamliel v'lo kasha. We can even explain it, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and say it's not a question. I explained it so that it was a problem, which is that the shvachot and the avadim that we're speaking about here are an ama ivriya and an Eved Ivri. What we're going to explain now is that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position is kan be'Eved Ivri, kan be'Eved Kenani. That when it comes to the restriction against the woman acquiring an Eved, that's an Eved Ivri. She may not acquire a Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave. What we are saying by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is that you have the right to acquire, or she can acquire, a Shivcha Knanit or an Eved Knani. It seems counterintuitive. You would expect that the Jewish woman would be able to acquire an Eved Ivri rather than an Eved Knani. An Eved Knani is someone who is much more suspect in terms of his behavior, much more suspect in terms of his loyalty to the woman versus the Eved Ivri. So why don't you expect it to be the other way around? So Gemara explains, Eved Ivri Tzniyalo. An Eved Ivri is someone who conducts himself in a manner of humility, a manner of modesty, by which, if he engages in some sort of affair with the woman, he would not publicize it. He would do it in a quiet or secret manner. And that's exactly what we're afraid of. We're afraid of the fact that now she has this Eved Ivri that will lead to some untoward behavior with the Eved Ivri, and that it'll be covered up. On the other hand, Eved Kenani, Paritzla. The Eved Kenani has no compunctions about speaking about it. He's not modest in any way. And therefore, she will be afraid to engage with the Eved Kenani because he will basically publicize or talk about whatever happened. And that's going to then ruin it for her, ruin her reputation, or ruin her standing. So she's willing to engage with the Eved Ivri because the Eved Ivri will keep things quiet. She'll be afraid to engage with the Eved Kenani because he's the type of guy that will announce everything that happens or maybe even be proud of what happened. And that will get her into trouble. So therefore, she won't engage with the Eved Kenani. So it turns out that even though the Eved Kenani is much more promiscuous and his behavior is much more questionable, we allow her to buy the Eved Kenani because the same things that make his behavior problematic also make her afraid to engage with the Eved Kenani. The Eved Ivri, on the other hand, where there is less promiscuity, or we would believe he's a Jew and he follows the laws of the Torah, nevertheless, over there, since he is more willing or more likely to cover it up or keep it quiet, she's more likely to engage with him. And therefore, that's how we'll explain Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion to reconcile with the Braita that we brought. Alaha, the Tani Rav Yosef. What about this Braita that Rav Yosef brings down? Amalata lotar bi kalba. A widow should not bring up a dog or have a dog as a pet in her house. Lo tishrei bar beirav bushpiza. And she should also not be the hostess for the Talmidim in the yeshiva. In those days, all the way till the times of the Velazhner yeshiva, the yeshiva students were boarded by the families in the town where the yeshiva was kept. So a widow should not be the hostess for the yeshiva students. So Bishlama bar beirav tzniyala. It makes sense that we don't allow the young Talmud Chacham to live there because if something untoward happens between them, he's again a modest individual. They're not going to publicize the issue. And it will be kept hushed up. If that's the case, we worry about that situation. Since a dog, if there is bestiality committed with the dog, she'll be afraid because the dog then just follows after them. That dog will follow the woman and stick to her because he thinks that she is his mate at this point, and then it'll become public, or everybody will be obvious that the dog or she engaged with the dog. Well, if you give a dog a nice piece of meat, a roasted meat, he also follows you as well. The reason that the dog's following after her is because she feeds him or takes care of him. So it's not obvious as to what is transpiring. The Balei Tosafot that we say over here that this is all mishum lazut svatayim ba'alma. This problem is only because of rumors that will circulate or reputational issues. Because of fish sholeich acharea, shelo nechdishu Yisrael azachor v'ala beima. We know from the Mishnah in Kiddushin, the Mishnah says that Bnei Yisrael are not nechshad on bestiality or on homosexuality, and therefore there's no Iser Yichud, there's no Iser whatsoever. This is all just for reputational side, that the woman shouldn't do this. And again, maybe in the modern era where people don't think about this at all, it wouldn't be an issue. It was clearly about their times where people saw a dog that was following after a widow. They started to question or spread rumors about what exactly was going on. So here, the Tani Rav Yosef is following what we just said before, which is that we try to avoid situations in which there might be problematic behavior, but especially situations in which the individuals will cover up the situation. Because then the woman's not afraid of engaging the individual because she knows it won't be found out. If it is somehow going to be publicized or made public, then the person's always afraid to engage in the behavior because of the risks that are associated with the publicization of the activity. Okay, ger toshav amur leinyan ribit mahi. Now, the other thing that Rabbi said is, the ger toshav by ribit, I don't understand. What is that? Tichtiv, it says, v'chi yamuch achicha, When your brother falls in hard times, umata yado imach, and he falters to you, vechzakta bo, you should strengthen him, you should upright him, ger v'toshav, vechayimach, and he will live together with you, al tikach mito neshech v'tarbit, do not take interest from him, or do not charge him interest, v'yireita melukecha, and you should fear God, vechayachichayimach, and then he should be able to live together with you. V'rimini, is this really true, that the ger toshav that is mentioned in the pasuk, seems to be subject to the same rules as achicha, meaning that you're not allowed to charge them interest, just like you're not allowed to charge your achicha, your brother, interest. Birmini, our Mishnah. Lavin mehen, you can borrow from them. Umalvin otam, and you can lend to them. That's speaking about a goy, biribit, with interest. V'chein beger toshav. Our Mishnah said that the same dinim applied to a ger toshav. And Rav Nachman Yitzhak, miktiv altikach mi'itam. It doesn't say in the pasuk, do not take from them, in the plural, but rather, mi'ito k'tiv. It says, from him, in the singular, mi'Yisrael. So what Rav Nachman Yitzhak is saying is that the ger toshav is only being qualified by a portion of the pasuk, not all of the pasuk. And that is, when it says over here, v'chegzaktabo, ger v'toshav v'chayimach, that part of the pasuk, the ger toshav is also included in, which is that you have a responsibility to try to help out the ger toshav, so that you are mitzuveh l'chachayoto, as Rashi says. You are commanded to help him out, to take care of him. But the al te'akach mi'ito neshech v'tarbit, which is written as mi'ito, only modifies achicha, and does not modify the ger toshav, because it's written in the singular. Had it said al te'akach mi'itam, then it would have been both achicha and ger toshav. You shouldn't take interest from. Now that it says al tikach mito, it means from achicha you may not take interest. From the ger toshav, you can take interest. So that's the interpretation of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak of the pasuk to explain why our Mishnah says that that's okay. Rabbi obviously thinks that al tikach mito is not definitive in giving that explanation. Al tikach mito we find many times in the Torah where it uses the singular form, even though it's referencing to everybody who was mentioned before. So that's why Rabbi was unclear about it. Here, Rav Nachman Yitzchak gives us a way to interpret the pasuk and reconcile with our Mishnah. Tarabanan, al tikach mito neshech v'tarbit, aval ata naseh lo arev. You may not take interest from him, but you are allowed to be a guarantor on the situation. So now, the guarantor means that you're guaranteeing for the debtor, on behalf of the debtor, facing the creditor. So where it says, arev l'man. Who exactly are you guaranteeing? Who is the creditor here by which you are guaranteeing the payments from the debtor? Ilema arev li Israel. If you say that he's guaranteeing the payments to a Jew, that means that the Jew is the lender, there's a Jewish borrower, and you step in to be a guarantor for the debtor, providing payments to the creditor. But that means that we have a situation in which the Jew is charging interest to a debtor, which is illegal, and you step in as an arev, as a guarantor, to guarantee the fact that he's going to pay back the debt and the interest. Vatana. And don't we have a Mishnah upcoming that says, Elu ovrim b'lo taseh. These are the people who violate the lo taseh of charging interest. Hamaveh, haloveh, harev, va'edim. The guarantor is one of those people that's in violation of charging interest. So just because you're not the borrower or the lender, the fact that you are the guarantor makes it that you're in violation of the Isur of Ribit. So that can't be the scenario. Ela l'nachri. It must be that he is a guarantor to a non-Jewish lender. There's a Jew borrowing from a non-Jewish lender, and the Jew is paying interest to the non-Jewish lender. You come in and guarantee on behalf of the debtor so that he will lend to the Jewish debtor. So that's the situation. The problem is, came into dinei d'nachri, dazil batar arva, iuniu d'kashakum yinei revita. The problem is, in the non-Jewish law, when you become the guarantor of a loan, you are the first line of defense. Which means that when the creditor wants to come collect the money, he doesn't even go and knock on the door of the debtor. He goes straight to the guarantor and says, pay me. Then the guarantor has to go and collect it from the loveh, from the borrower. So it's a way to prevent the creditor from having to take any credit risk with the borrower. He basically says, I don't even have to go to the borrower. I'll go straight to the guarantor, get my money, And then, after I get my money, you, the guarantor, work it out with the debtor. That's why you're a guarantor. You work it out. The problem with that now becomes that the Nachri is collecting interest from the guarantor. That's fine. But the guarantor then is going and collecting the interest from the Jew because of the way that it's structured now. In their dinim, that structure would mean that the guarantor goes to the debtor and collects whatever was taken from him by the Nachri. In essence, then you become a collector of interest. So I'm Rav Sheshet, Shekibel Alav Ladun B'dinei Yisrael. It's a case where it's a non-Jewish lender. You have a Jewish borrower and a Jewish guarantor. The Jewish guarantor is not subject to the rules of the non-Jewish courts because this lender, this non-Jewish lender, agreed to follow the Jewish law. So they put in the contract that it'll be subject, any adjudication, any issues will be subject to the Jewish law. In the Jewish law, you have to go after the debtor first. If the debtor defaults, then the arev, then the guarantor steps in, or you go after the guarantor. So that means that the Nachri all along is going to collect from the debtor. He's collecting the interest from the debtor. If the debtor defaults, then he'll go after the arev. So then, ikibel alav ladun b'dinei Yisrael, ribit nami lo lishko. If he accepted to follow the Jewish law, why is he taking interest? So, Amar Rav Sheshet, Shekibel Alav Lazo, V'lo Kibel Alav Lazo. It's simple. He accepted the fact that you go after the debtor first and not the guarantor first. He said that you will do that under the Jewish law, not like the Nachrim. But as far as interest is concerned, I'm not following the Jewish law. I'm going to charge interest. And Nachri is not subject to the rule of going to the debtor first either. He's just accepting, he's voluntarily keeping the Jewish law. So the Gemara asks, if he's voluntarily keeping the Jewish law, why doesn't he also not charge interest? The answer is, he's keeping the law with regards to going to the debtor first, then the guarantor. But with regards to interest, he is charging interest. The problem is, what happens when the debtor defaults? If the debtor defaults, the Nachri is going to go after the arev, and then the arev is going to go back after the debtor. So, yes, you don't have the problem all the time. But as soon as you have a default, aren't you back in the same boat, which is that the arev is paying interest to the Nachri, and then the debtor has to pay him. Rashi explains that it's different over here. Because in the case where he goes after the guarantor for the payments all along, that means that all along the interest payments are being made by the arev, and then the arev is going and collecting interest from the debtor, which causes the problem. Over here, when the debtor defaults, what ends up happening is the whole amount becomes the debt owed now. Whenever someone defaults, the default means that anything that you owed or accrued until this point in time is now outstanding debt. It's a big block of debt. When the arev pays the Nachri and then goes to the Jewish debtor to collect, he's not collecting interest from him. He's collecting a loan or a debt due to him. That's how Rashi explains it. At that moment, that's when the arev extends the loan. And what he lent to him, he is collecting back from him. At the moment the Nachri declares a default and goes after the arev, then the arev, in essence, at that moment, is lending money to the debtor. Until that point in time, he wasn't involved in the transaction. Once the debtor defaults, he's stepping in to fill in the debtor's shoes. That means that he's lending money to the debtor at that point in time. So when he lends that money to the debtor at that point in time, it's the principal plus interest. But it's a total payment, it's a total block that he's lending to the debtor or paying on behalf of the debtor. So then when he goes to collect from the debtor, he's collecting all principal from the debtor and no interest. So that's the difference between whether the arev is the first line of defense. If he's the first line of defense, then the Nachri is collecting interest for him on a regular basis for the loan extended to the arev. And then the arev, in turn, extends a loan to the debtor upon which he's collecting interest. And that's problematic. But then if you go to the debtor first, and then only if there's a default, go to the arev, when there is a default, the debtor now owes money. He owes principal plus interest. He owns a block of money. The arev steps in and basically lends the debtor the entire amount of money. That entire amount of money he lent him and gives it to the Nachri. So now when the arev goes to collect from the debtor, he's collecting a debt from him. He's not collecting interest from him because he lent him money that included principal and interest, but he lent him a block of money and he's collecting his block of money, and therefore it's not a problem of ribit in that case. In their law, since he goes to the arev first, it's the equivalent of him lending the money to the arev and the arev turning around and lending it to the debtor. There it's a two-stage transaction, because basically the Nachri lends money to the arev, and the arev lends money to the debtor, and that's the original principal amount. Then as each interest payment goes through, he is paying interest to the Nachri, and then going back to the Jew and asking him for interest payment on the loan. And so then in that case, if he upfront lent him 100 from the creditor to the arev, and then the arev turns around and lends that 100 to the debtor, then at the end of the term, When the Nachri demands his 120, the Arav pays his 120. But then the Arav goes back and collects 120 from the debtor. That's the loan that he extended to the debtor. So that's why it's considered to be interest and problematic. On the other hand, if the Arav only comes into the picture at the end when the 120 is due, then he's lending 120 to the Jew. He's not lending him 100 and collecting 120. He's lending 120 and expecting 120 back. All right, so now here we get to the latter half of the Mishnah. And the latter half of the Mishnah says, Malve Yisrael ma'utav shel nachri midat nachri. A Jew can lend the monies of a nachri to the knowledge of the nachri. Tanu Rabbanan. Malve Yisrael ma'utav shel nachri midat nachri, avalo midat Yisrael, which is the phrase that we have in the Mishnah. Ketzad. Now, in this braita, it explicates on what's the case that our Mishnah is speaking about. Yisrael shel lavah ma'ot min nachri biribit. A Jew is a debtor to a nachri on an interest-bearing loan. So he borrowed money, he's paying interest on it. And he's done. He's done with the loan, and now he wants to return the money to the Nachri. Matzo Yisrael Acher, another Jew sees him going to pay the money back to the Nachri, and says, Ramar lo, it's namely, lend me the money, v'ani ale lecha kederek she'atam ale lo, and I'll pay you the interest like you're paying to the Nachri, asur. In that case, it is asur. In this case, the Jew who is going to return the money to Nachri is going to erase the debt. He has outstanding loan. He wants to repay the loan now, and that will cancel his obligation to the Nachri. So the Jew bumps into him and says, don't do that. Keep the money outstanding. Keep the loan outstanding, and I'll take over the loan. But the structure of the loan here is not that the Nachri is transferring the money from one debtor to another debtor, but in a sense, the second debtor is becoming a sub-debtor to the first debtor. He's saying, just keep the outstanding loan outstanding, and then you'll pay interest in, but it'll be a flow through, because I'll pay you interest, and then you'll flow that interest through the Nachri. That is asur. The Gemara will discuss what exactly the scenario is, but that's because the structure is a structure similar to what we just saw with the Arev under non-Jewish law, which is that the first Yisrael is a borrower with interest from the Nachri. The second Yisrael is a borrower from the Yisrael, who is the debtor, paying him interest. If he gave it back to the Nachri, then it's mutar. We'll have to see what that means. But if he somehow passed the money through the Nachri, then it would be mutar, because in essence, that means that it's a new loan to the other Jew. Tosfot asks on this piece of the Braita, why is it that when he says, listen, I'll give you the money and you'll pass the money along to the creditor, is it problematic? Even if he paid the creditor directly, it would be problematic. Because the Baal Tosafot say that in essence, debtor number one, Yisrael number one, becomes a guarantor, an arev, for the loan. Because he never returned the loan to the Nachri. And then when debtor number two takes out the loan, and it keeps it extant, and says, I'll pay you, and then you'll pay the Nachri, even if debtor number two was to say, I'll pay the Nachri directly, that wouldn't change anything because debtor number one is still on the hook for the money and he's an arev, he's a guarantor. And as a guarantor, it's as if he is taking the money from the creditor, giving it to the debtor number two, and debtor number two is as if he's paying through the arev, and then the arev is paying the creditor. And so in that case, that's what says, Eino Chanami, it would also be asur. Even if debtor number two paid it directly to the creditor, it would be asur. The Rashba, as the Groa says over here, says that's not the case. The only time an Arev is considered to be problematic is where the Arev is the first line of defense, and everything goes through the Arev. In this situation, the debtor number two is going directly to the creditor and paying him. And if that's the case, it would be fine, because the Arev is only on the hook if debtor number two defaults. So the Rashba says that Tosafot's assumption of Arevut here is incorrect. And that if it had been that the debtor number two said, I'll pay directly to the Nachri, it would have been fine. It's only because he's paying it to the Yisrael, debtor number one, that it's problematic. The Baal Tosafot feel that even if debtor number two pays it directly to Nachri, it's problematic, because debtor number one becomes an Arev, and as we saw in the Gemara, being an Arev is problematic. And therefore the Baal Tosafot say that the reason the Braita said it's a case where he's passing it through Yisrael number one is for the latter half of the Mishnah, where it says, Hemido. If he gave it back to the Nachri, then debtor number one is okay. Even if the debtor number two is paying the money through debtor number one to the Nachri, he's just a conduit. He is not the creditor, or he's not accepting the interest from the debtor number two. And that's why it's mutar, and that's the chiddush of why it says it in that manner. Israel beribit. A non-Jew borrowed money from Israel paying interest. And he's done with the loan, and now he wants to return the money. Mitzahu Yisrael Acher, a Jew bumps into this Nachri, and says to him, Amarlo, it's namely, I'll pay you interest the same way that you're paying him interest. So that's fine, because there's a middleman here. The middleman who is borrowed from the original Israel is allowed to pay interest to Israel. The second debtor, who's a Jew, can borrow from the Nachri and pay interest to the Nachri. So in this case, the Nachri being in the middle makes this all mutar. The same way it was problematic in the previous case with the Israel in the middle. Now with the Nachri in the middle, it actually makes it better. Because you have a two-staged loan. You have a loan that the Nachri has outstanding with the Jew, which he will now keep outstanding. And then he lends that money, instead of returning it to the Jew, he'll lend that money to another Jew, and he'll be the middleman. But in that case, debtor number two, the Israel, is paying interest to the Nachri, and the Nachri, debtor number one, is paying interest to the creditor, who's a Jew, and that's fine. If he puts it together with the Israel, or somehow he gets it back to the original owner, then it is asur. Bishlama seifa l'chumra. I understand why in the seifa we say that it is problematic, is because we go to chumra. And the chumra, we assume that there is shlichut l'nachri. El reisha, kevin de'ein shlichut l'nachri. In the reisha case, since there is no shlichut, ability for a nachri to act as a proxy, iu niu de kashako mine rivita. Therefore, he is taking the interest from him. So in the latter case, in the seifa case, where we put it back with the Jew, and then the Jew basically, we're going to see what the case is, makes the Nachri his shaliach, then the Chumra, we say the Nachri functions as a shaliach, and it's as if the Jew is lending to a Jew. Remember, in the seifa case, the Nachri was the debtor number one, and now debtor number two is a Jew, wants to take it from the Nachri. So we said, if he asks the Nachri for the money, it works fine, because the Nachri keeps the loan outstanding, and then he lends separately. It's a new transaction. He lends it to debtor number two, the Israel. That's fine. But im he may do it slow. If he went back to the Israel and he returned the money, and the Israel says, you know what? Be my agent and give that money to Jew number two. So in that case, we said it's asur. Why? Because we say the chumra that there's a shlichut anachri, and since there is shlichut anachri, he's acting on behalf of the Israel. And therefore we look at it as if the Israel lent directly to the other Israel, to debtor number two, even though the Nachri is the one who is moving the money from himself to debtor number two. We look at him as a proxy of the creditor who is a Jew, and that's why it's asur. But in the reisha, where the case is reversed, and it is a case where a Jew borrowed from a Nachri, and then debtor number two, who is also a Jew, wants to borrow from Jew number one, and we said if the Nachri tells him, you know what, instead of returning the money to me, on my behalf, give it to Jew number two, to debtor number two, we said over there was mutar, which means that the Jew is able to function as an agent of the Nachri. But if you want to go to Chumrah and say that there is no agency by a Nachri, then in essence, Jew number one, debtor number one, was lending to Jew number two, debtor number two, because the agency that he acted on behalf of the Nachri doesn't exist. The Gemara says, how is that possible? Why is that allowed? So the Gemara says, Amar Ravuna bar Manoach, Mishrei de Rav Acha, Brei de Rav Ika, Hocha b'may eskinan. What's the case here? Gaon d'amarle, henicham al gabe karka v'hipater. The creditor says to the individual, listen, just put them down on the ground there, and you are patur. You've discharged your obligation as far as returning the money. So then, when the next party, the next debtor comes and picks up the money, he's picking up the money from Hefker, it's not from the debtor number one, who's a Jew, as being an intermediary, giving him the money. Where it says, Yehochi, Maila Memra. Wait a minute. If that's the case, what's the chiddush over here? Why is there a chiddush? If he puts him down on the ground and the next party picks them up, of course, middleman is not involved in the charging of interest. It all has to do with the original creditor and debtor number two. They're the one with the relationship now. Why do you have to tell me that by a Jew it's asur and by an achri it would be mutar? El amra papa, gagon shenatal v'natan biyad. It's a case where the creditor took the money back physically and then handed it back. Where it says, Vakate, Milo Membra. Why is that a chedesh? Meaning that that's the equivalent of returning the money and then initiating a new transaction. Mara asks you a question, Milo Membra, what's the chedesh over here? If you're passing it through the creditor, then of course the debtor number one is out of the picture. And that's why he's willing to give it. Kamash Malon. So what we would have thought is, the only reason the creditor is giving the money to debtor number two is at the request of debtor number one. Debtor number two never went directly to the creditor. Debtor number two went to debtor number one. So debtor number one then goes to the creditor and says, why don't you give the money to debtor number two? So debtor number one is now the facilitator of the money moving from himself to debtor number two. So I would have thought, since he is the cause or the impetus for the loan being extended, that that would be equivalent of him handing the money directly from himself to debtor number two. Even though it passes through the creditor is just doing that as a formality to take the money back and say, oh, you're repaid now, we're moving on to the next loan. But maybe the whole reason that he's giving it to debtor number two is because of the lobbying or advocacy of debtor number one, and therefore debtor one will be considered to be responsible as if he still has the loan outstanding. Kamash Malon, that we don't say that. Once it passes back through the hands of the creditor, we erase whatever happened before, and whatever starts now is a new transaction. The Rabbeinu Tam says over here that the answer of Rav Papa of Nosem and Noten B'Yad not only answers the question until now, it also upends or removes the statement of the Gemara now that Bishlama Seifa L'Chumra, that the Seifa is the Chumra because we assume that there is Shlichut and Achrei L'Chumra. But now that you have Rav Papa's answers, Rav Papa's answer of Nosem and Noten B'Yad can answer both the Reisha and the Seif of the Mishnah, and you no longer have to say that there's Shlichut and Achrei L'Chumra. On the other hand, Rashi and the Rabbeinu Chananel suggest that the Seifa remains an issue of Shlichut of the Nachrei L'Chumra, and Nosem and Noten B'Yad is only an answer for the Reisha. Rav Ashi suggests a different answer. Ki Amrina Nein Shlichut the Nachrei. When do we say there's no agency for an achrei? Hani mile b'truma. That is from truma. Truma is the source for the fact that there is agency. That's not exactly true because there are other psukim by which we learn agency. We learned that in the Gemara in Kiddushin. How do we know that? Shlocho shel adam kimoto. But truma is the location by which we know that an achrei is excluded. Aval, b'chol ha-torah kula yesh shlichut an achrei. Outside of truma, there is agency for an achrei. Vahadar Ravashi Berutahi. That which Ravashi says, now here the gear says bruta, which means bara, is an outside statement, meaning that it's not acceptable or does not make sense. The gear in other places is bedutahi. Bedutahi would mean that it is a joke, or it is something that was attributed to him, but he clearly did not say it, because it doesn't make any sense. So either way, whether it's bruta or bedutahi, it's an outright rejection of this statement because the statement makes no sense. Which is, maishna truma dolo. Why is it by truma that we do not allow an achri to be an agent? Dichtim, because the pasuk says, atem gam atem. Ma atem b'nei brit. Just like you are Jewish, af shluchachem nami b'nei brit. So too your agents have to be Jewish. Shlichut d'chol ha-torah kula nami mitruma gamrinen la. Truma is a paradigm by which we learn Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoto and the Chol HaTorah Kula. So therefore, if the din is such by Truma, it would extend to the Chol HaTorah Kula. And therefore, if by Shlichut of the Truma, there is a requirement, number one, that the agent be just like you, so the agent must be a Ben Brit, but also Atem, you must be a Ben Brit. So both the principal and the agent have to be B'nai Brit. And in our case over here, in the Breita, in each case, there's a failure on one side. In one case, it's principal is an Achri, in one case, the agent is an Achri. Both of those, we say, Ein Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoto. Ela Deravashi Brutai. Ravashi is clearly problematic. That is not a solution to our problem in the Breita. And we'll have to go back to the solution that was suggested by Rav Papa, which is Kagon Shin Natal Venatan Biyad, that the creditor actually took possession and gave over the money, and the Havamina was that because it was done at the impetus of the debtor number one, that he would be as if debtor number one gave it to debtor number two. Igad Amre, some say Amar Ravashi, Ki Amrin Anech Tuchud Anachri Animile Inu Lididan. That's only true when they are acting at his origin. Avalanan Lididhu Havinan Lehu Shliach. But if they are the principal and we are an agent, that it would work, that it's only a one-way problem. The only problem is where they are agents, but where they are the principal and we are agents, it wouldn't be problematic. And again here, Hadravashi Brutai. Vashi is outside, or Abdutai is a joke. Maishnainu didan delo. Why is it that they cannot be agents for us? The pasuk says atem gam atem rabot shluchachem, to include your agents. Ma atem b'nei brit, just like you are Jews. Av shluchachem b'nei brit, so too your agents must be Jewish. Anan lididhu nami. We for them, meaning that they're the principal and we are the agent, it doesn't work as well, because it says atem b'nei brit kamar, you are Jewish. Meaning that the whole premise of the statement in Truma is, just like you are Jewish, then your agents must be Jewish. But that assumes that the principal is Jewish. If the principal is not Jewish, then the whole thing falls apart to start with. El had Ravashi brutai. It's clear here that Ravashi's statement is incorrect, and that you can't accept this. There is no shlichut l'nachri. If there's no agency for a nachri in either direction, then you have to figure out why the Braita differentiates in the cases, and that's what we explained before, according to Rav Papa. Tosfot also quotes from the Yerushalmi the fact that when it comes to the monies of Israel, where a non-Jew is the executor of the estate, or the monies of the Jew, or vice versa, where the Nachri has monies, and a Jew is an executor of the estate, or in charge of the estate, we look at who is the underlying owner of the money, and determining whether it's mutar or asur. So it doesn't matter who the executor is, it matters who is responsible or whose money it is. And therefore, if the underlying ownership is that of a Jew, even though a non-Jew is running the portfolio, it's asur for him to charge interest to another Jew. And vice versa, if it is an underlying portfolio of the non-Jew, and a Jew is running it, he can charge interest to a Jew, because he's really lending the money of the Nachri to the Jew. Rabbi Amar, Nehi de shlichu de Nachri leitle, Zchia midraban itle, mide de havi akotan. Ravina says, okay, I can accept the fact that there is no shlichut anachri because that's min haTorah. The Torah states specifically that there is no agency for a nachri. On the other hand, at least midrabanan, he should have a right of acquisition, or that you can acquire on his behalf. You can act to be zochen she'adam shelo b'fanav, that you're able to function and create a zchia for someone, even though you're not able to be their shliach. Mide havi akatan. Similar to a katan. Ma katan lafa vagav delet leishlichut. A katan cannot be an agent. Can't be a principal either, because in the parshiot it says ish. And ish means that he has to be of age. Without that, it won't work. So, therefore, there is no shlichut the katan. But nevertheless, it lay zchia midrabanan. He still has a zchia midrabanan because zochin the katan. You can acquire something on behalf of a katan if it's for his benefit. So hachanami, loshna. Over here, it should be the same thing. The goy, even though he does not have rights of agency, he should still have rights of zchia, at least midrabanan. And even though it's only a din derabanan, we would still say that it would take away the problem of ribit deoraita, either because we would say hefker, beitin, hefker, and therefore beitin has the right to create a situation in which they can confiscate someone's property, and therefore since it's a din derabonan, they make it as if there's no ownership here, and that takes away the din d'oraita. That's a little harder to say here, because that really works when they have auspices over the individual. If you're dealing with the nachri, it's not clear that they have auspices to say hefker, beitin, hefker. So what you'd have to suggest is that maybe the ribit here is only a din ribit midrabanan. And that is what the Tosafot in Bishlamash, Sefer the Chumrah, notes, or tries to explain why here the Isur is only an Isur de Rabbanan, and not an Isur de Oraita of Ribit. And therefore the Zchia mid Rabbanan would override the Isur Ribit mid Rabbanan, because then it's a Rabbanan and a Rabbanan, so that would work. Where it says, Velohi, that's not a good comparison, and Ravina's assumption is incorrect. Yisrael at Ati Lechlal Shlichut. A Katan eventually will be able to act as an agent. He will grow into being an agent. Therefore, up front, the Chachamim gave him a right of zchia, because eventually he will have agency. Akum lo ati lechlau shlichut. And Akum will never reach the point where they are able to be an agent or function properly as an agent, because the Torah precludes them. Therefore, the Chachamim didn't grant them the right of zchia. And so therefore, that won't be the answer to the problem here, which is that one possibility was zchia would be the replacement for shlichut in the Braita. The Gemara says that's not true, because it's not necessarily right that a Nachri has a din of Zchia, even though he doesn't have a din of Shlichut, because a Katan is different, because a Katan eventually will become a full-fledged agent, and therefore in the beginning is given that right of Zchia. Okay, we'll stop here, three lines down on the top of Ayin Bet, Amud Aleph.